What happened next? One of the first things people do in retirement is to set about all those tasks that they've been too busy to complete whilst working. I had a few of these, including an 18th century house that always needed some attention, similar demands from two old classic cars, and a garden of several acres that we'd allegedly created from a field to be low maintenance. The tall hedges and lush planting, as well as the mowing, seemed to belie this claim. The good news was that my wife and our last remaining dog, an energetic collie cross, both seemed happy to spend more time with me, and the feeling was mutual. Shortly after retiring, the opportunity came up to buy a modest holiday home in an area we'd been going to for a number of years. In a small house in Crete, published on Amazon, I tell the story of this, as well as our enrolment at home in Sussex in a Greek school for weekly classes in an attempt to at least acquire some Greek language skills. The most beneficial part of this was being thrown into a Greek environment for a two-hour class, which was the usual Southern European form of organised friendly chaos. Pupils and their parents, as the majority of the class were children, would arrive and depart at random times in the two-hour lesson slot. The classes were held in a church hall attached to a Victorian church, now converted by the Cypriot community to a Greek Orthodox church, complete with icons and incense burners. So there was also the occasional appearance of the Greek Orthodox priest who would bless the class at the start and end of the term and also appear on saint or name days. This was usually accompanied by the sprinkling of holy water using the traditional bunches of basil, not a welcome ordeal for some of the teenage girls who'd already prepared for the weekend with routines of hair washing and straightening. Initially, the lessons were provided by one of the church elders, Mr. Nikos Bouras, and the textbooks used were Greek junior school books of a Janet and John genre. The children in the stories were supplemented by Disney characters, so we found ourselves learning to read, write and speak Goofy would like to play bat and ball. Not really the vocabulary that I could see being useful to me. Now, if Goofy wants to buy a full tank of unleaded petrol for his hire car, we may be making progress. That would probably be covered in later lessons. Classes in the years following the first one were taken by Greek students, who the Greek Ministry of Culture would pay for, and it allowed them to earn money while studying. The three that taught us over the years were all mature students, in their 30s and qualified teachers. Mr. Bouras was rather territorial over the teaching and insisted that they spend a number of weeks observing his teaching before being allowed to teach solo, which must have been somewhat frustrating for them. Eventually they took over, although I quite like Mr. Bouras teaching us, as we used to have lengthy digressions over the origins of Greek words and their incorporation into the English language. I genuinely found this helped me to remember the vocabulary, although the other students enjoyed catching up on gossip while this conversation took place. It also put off the dreaded marking of the homework. Yes, we had homework set. The other unexpected bonus from the Greek class was my re-entry into the art world, which I'd left around the age of 15 when choosing GCE O-level subjects. My red brick grammar school didn't consider art to be a useful academic subject, so I'd reluctantly been persuaded to drop art at GCE O-level in favour of more prestigious Latin or additional maths. On the drive home after Greek school, we passed a double-fronted ground floor gallery building that always looked busy with a group of people chatting and holding wine glasses. We recognised that it must be a private view evening, but we were intrigued that it seems to be a weekly event. One week our curiosity got the better of us and we called in. That evening I could tell the framed art on the wall was the work of several different artists, and through the crowded room we made our way to the reception desk, where we were welcomed and asked to sign in to be put on their mailing list. A form was given to us to sign up to become members of what we discovered was the Hastings Art Forum. We could be guests of that evening, and we were encouraged to help ourselves to a glass of wine each, provided by the exhibitors. This all seemed very hospitable. As we looked at the art on the walls through the crowded room, A smiley man asked us if we liked the work in what we'd easily recognise as a Scottish accent. We said we did and asked if any of it was his work. And when he modestly showed us some beautiful coloured portraits that he described as monoprints, a term I was unfamiliar with, but was known to my wife, her education and background having followed a much more artistic path than I had. My inquiry to George, as we were to discover he was called, whether he'd always been a professional artist, was met with laughter. Oh no, I had a career in IT. I only started this a couple of years ago. A number of us here attend a weekly print class at Hastings College. Come along this Friday, I'll arrange for you to see what we do, and later perhaps arrange a free trial session. It's all very relaxed. I looked again at the rich colours of the framed art and George's smiling face and thought, why not? Friday found me a little less confident as I drove to Hastings, but George was very friendly, and what did I have to lose? I could always say it wasn't for me. The art college was just above the seafront, housed in what seemed to be the basement of a Victorian building. Although once inside, there was natural light down towards the sea where the ground sloped. There were some dozen artists of mixed ages, and George welcomed me but wearing a paint-stained apron, saying it's best not to dress up for printing. He introduced me to the tutor and then gave me a tour of the studio. There were printing beds for the silk screens, drying racks, rows of tables, a huge light box like a jumbo photocopier, and a wet room for spray cleaning the screens. He explained the process of producing silkscreen prints from photos, which was a technique that interested me more than the monoprinting, which looked to be a more skillful technique. And he explained that Ian, the tutor, would explain what I would need for next week to produce my own image. After an initial trial session, I signed up for the full term a couple of weeks later. A few months later, I had sold the first two limited edition prints at an event in a restaurant in Lewes, much to my surprise and pleasure. Within a year, I joined a group of several other printers for our first group exhibition. To our relief, we all sold work, and it more than recovered the large wine bill that made for a memorable evening. My work was mostly using photographs taken in Sussex and Crete and digitally working on the Mono Mac before creating the image sets to transfer to screens. Images photographed in the villages on the Isle of Crete comprise some of my early prints with doors and windows offering easy photogenic subjects. I enjoyed the mix of creating hand-printed silkscreen from digital photos. I also tried some etching and monoprinting, but wasn't ever truly satisfied with the results. I carried on printing for several more years at the college and made some great friends there, all arising from stopping in a gallery one night. So many thanks, George, for inspiring me. Your art is still more accomplished than mine is, but it's not a competition. I'm also grateful to tutors Ian, Miles and Jackie, as well as learning from other colleagues on the course, especially George Mundell, Del Querns and Andy Smith, who's a successful and well-known commercial artist and printer. Contact there led to another new experience when fellow printer Del set up a new business with his business partner Richard, a record shop. And who of my generation hasn't wanted to work in a record shop? I recommend Music's Not Dead to music fans. At the time, Del and Richard had taken a lease on premises in Bexhill Town that was previously a cafe. They were going for a cheap and cheerful makeover before an early opening to sell CDs and vinyl. I offered to help, and a week of cleaning and painting followed before a carpenter came in to create the shelving racks and a counter. After the opening, I spent the odd days serving there to help out when Rich was off. It was an interesting experience and great to reminisce with customers about favourite albums and bands we'd seen. Many customers were buying back catalogue items, and it was amusing to see awestruck young customers reacting to hearing that you'd seen The Doors or Hendrix live. A nice nostalgia experience, though hard work, I'm sure, as a business. The business has developed, extending the range of vinyl and putting on live events as well as a mail order business. It's become a destination for musicians and musos from all over the south of England and further away. The shop has since moved into the Art Deco Seafront Delaware Pavilion, making it, I would contend, the only Grade 1 listed record shop in existence. As a result of our house move, I can only visit occasionally, and my several Saturdays working in the music business are just another happy memory. The other avenue that the house in Crete opened up to me is what's happening here on this page. We spend a lifetime writing as students, corresponding by letter and latterly by emails and text. Some of us also apply this skill in our work to a greater or lesser extent. But it's common for people to muse, I could write a book on that. The experience of finding, buying and renovating the house in Crete made me think that I had material that was interesting enough to write down, and just maybe others would find the content interesting enough to read. Advances in desktop publishing and the use of the internet to publish, market and distribute it have all made this more possible. I did briefly experiment with re-entering the world of work via the popular Rotary consultancy. I'd seen an advert somewhere for experienced professionals to join a small consultancy specialising in coaching and change management using short-term contracts. Some weeks after sending off my CV, I was invited to an interview day in a hotel near Birmingham, where several dozen other applicants had also been invited. We were given details about the consultancy, who were based on the Welsh border but operated nationally. Their approach was described to us, and we were told there would be a series of induction days for us to learn their prescribed approach before we'd been involved in any chargeable assignments. A few days later, I was phoned and asked if I was still interested and would I be willing to attend the first induction day at their offices. As I was not sure about being fully retired in my mid-50s, I agreed to attend. A group of 10 prospective consultants attended the first induction day, which was described as free of charge, but we were to pay for our own travel and any necessary accommodation for the days. Our backgrounds varied. A couple of us were newly retired from industry. Others had come from careers in education or local authorities. The approach of the consultancy appeared sensible and practical, with most of the current and planned client base being in the fields of education or local government. There was talk of NLP, that's neuro-linguistic programming, and other jargon-laden management speak. But once I'd stripped away the jargon, I recognised much of it as sensible change management processes. I agreed to attend a further session before committing to any contractual arrangements. In the event, after several more training days, I only worked on 3 short-term assignments of a day or two's duration during the next few months. Apart from one assignment in East London, the other two were in the Midlands and the north of England, and the travel and tax implications of such a small amount of work led me to question whether this was something I would persevere with. I must admit the structured training gave me an idea that I could apply my experience from my career together with this as an independent coach. And since retirement, I've undertaken a few assignments as such, some paid, some free, and I've enjoyed all of them. One took place over a longer period and included an ascent to the top of Nelson's Column in Trafalgar Square, where the company was undertaking a stone restoration project. This is somewhere I never thought I'd find myself, and I'm not over keen on heights. But thank you, Adrian, for the experience. The same assignment found me running a business planning session at the Institute of Directors in Pall Mall, where to my astonishment, an old school and university friend, Vernon, was one of the board members there. This led later to a very convivial lunch and a catch-up after a gap of some decades. Socialising after a working life can also lead to unexpected events. As my office was almost an hour's drive away and fellow inmates would be commuting possibly for another direction, it was unlikely that after work you could socialise easily unless it was pre-arranged. Some of this became possible in retirement with the establishment of regular pub lunch meetings arranged by email. But an amusing event took place at a more formally arranged meeting. We'd been invited to lunch in the next town by a retired colleague and his wife, along with another couple that we knew. The husband was also a fellow retiree and a bit of a stickler for formality. We'd already met as a group, having an informal kitchen supper at our house a few weeks before. To preserve anonymity and avoid any further embarrassment, I would omit any names, but the lady host had pushed the boat out with lunch arranged in a large formal dining room, with a table laid out with the best dinner service, cutlery, and an array of expensive crystal glassware. After a pre-lunch drink, we took our seats to eat the first course, when my fellow guest suddenly lurched to one side as his dining chair gave way under him. There was no real damage apart from pride and the chair. The host expressed surprise and started a forensic examination of the chair, which didn't surprise me as he'd been one of the company's more cerebral employees with a clutch of qualifications and a national reputation for developing complex mathematical models. The hostess was less impressed and pressed her husband to remove the offending item and bring him another chair. Reluctantly, he did. So while speculating on the damaging effects of modern heating systems on pre-20th century family heirlooms, lunch recommenced. But the restored fragile peace was soon interrupted by a second collapsing chair, this time to the partner of the first victim. The wooden culprit was more speedily replaced on this occasion, but the lunch party nervously sat out the next three courses, and I avoided second offerings of any of the heavier foods available, and ate less than my usual helping of cheese and biscuits. Coffee was served in the sitting room on a substantial sofas, much to the relief of everyone. The journey home was quiet until after we were dropped off in our drive, and the car with the erstwhile furniture vandals had driven off, when both of us degenerated into hysterical laughter. I soon recovered, although Stephanie only had to save the chairs for her hysterics to return, and this went on for several days, even though I mentioned that the joke, rather like the chair frames, was wearing a bit thin. Strangely, the damaging couple didn't invite the four of us to their house for a return meal, perhaps fearing some damaging reprisals, and in the years since, the incident hasn't been a topic of conversation, until now.